Hi, welcome back to another episode of Real World Serverless, a podcast where I speak with real world practitioners and get their stories from the trenches. Today, I'm honored to be joined by Austin Collins, who is the founder and CEO of Serverless Inc. And you may know him as the guy that created the serverless framework. Hey, Austin, good to finally have you on the show.
Hey, Ann, great to be here. It's an honor to be here. You know, few have been in the serverless movement, you know, producing quality content as long as you have. So super excited to be on the show and just to have a, you know, an interesting talk with you about all things serverless.
Yeah, I've been using the server framework for so long. It's still my my preferred option when it comes to doing any work with AWS and serverless. So I was big thanks to you in terms of all the work I've been doing the last couple of years with serverless stuff.
It's amazing to hear you say that too. You know, when did you get started? I'm just curious. Like, what was your introduction to serverless? How long ago was that?
Yeah, that was, I think 2015 was when I first started trying to do stuff with Lambda and Kinesis at the time. That was just before API Gateway integration was announced at the reInvent 2015. I think that was a big turning point in terms of now you can build entire systems using, you know, serverless stuff. I think when Lambda first launched in 2014, it was just, you know, S3 trigger, and then I think Kinesis, so you can do some kind of, you know, some small bits of stuff. So you know, upload the file to S3, you can do some automatic processing with Lambda. But then once they introduced the API Gateway, that became a game changer. You can actually do more general purpose compute stuff with Lambda and build, you know, real systems. So I started working with Lambda just before, you know, API Gateway integrations was available. Back then, I actually tried JAWS, which, funny enough, didn't quite work out of the box. It was a nice idea, but I think just the execution wasn't quite there. And I tried it, spent a bit of time just trying to tinkering to make it work. And then I think 2016, when I started doing I left one job with an e-commerce company, went to work for a social network in 2016. And that's when I, you know, started to, I guess, my first really big fully serverless project. And I think at that point, you guys had the 0.5 or something version. That was the current version of a server framework. At least at that point, it was fairly stable. It was usable. Everything I needed to do was able to do that with the serverless framework. So, you know, basically, it saved me from having to create a lot of my custom build tools and deployment tools. And so that was my first big entry into serverless, moving this social network to running a bunch of EC2 instances where no one can debug anything to running everything in Lambda and trying to figure out a lot of the patterns and what does it actually look like to run a serverless application in production, how to do debugging, how to do logging, how to do testing, all these things that that people haven't quite worked out. So we spent a lot of time just figuring a lot of those things out. And the server thing was a big part of that. That's when I got into serverless, almost 8 years now, I guess.
Yeah, you were there right at the beginning. Like that was, everything really started to come together. And I forgot you were a JAWS user. And maybe I could back up and just explain some of the context for listeners and stuff and kind of get into our story a little bit. I'm Austin, created the serverless framework back in 2015 after Lambda came out, and solo founded a company called Serverless Inc. based on the success of the serverless framework. I'm an AWS community hero. I think I was one of the first few serverless heroes. And what else is relevant? Also created a specification adopted by the CNCF called Cloud Events for standardizing metadata on event payloads so that they're easier to transmit across environments and just be more portable generally. And today, still running Serverless Inc. and with a bunch of awesome teammates. So we live and breathe serverless. But I got started back in early 2015, actually late, it was 2014 when Lambda came out. And for me, it was a game-changing moment because you know, I'm at the end of the day just a developer, and I want to build all the things. And I love like the empowerment that comes with great developer tools and cloud services in particular. And I was already such a fan of managed services and thinking like this has got to be the natural evolution of the cloud. You know, let's have kind of APIs for every use case that are auto-scaling, you know, pay per use, never pay per idle. And a lot of what development could be is just composing these things together to make, you know, broader applications and, you know, larger use cases without having to need a ton of money or a huge team to do that. And so I was, you know, such a huge fan of that, and that general theme of just like empowering the few over existing kind of power hierarchies is just, you know, what it's all about for me when it comes to dev tools. And so then Lambda came out, and Lambda solved this missing piece of like, well, here's how you can run custom code business logic really easily in a way that's like a lot of these other managed, you know, which we now call kind of serverless services. And all of a sudden, you know, when I saw that, I thought there's opportunity, or there's a new architecture on the horizon. Like there's a new architecture that's possible. Let's like, can we build entire use cases and applications on all these managed services and just putting our custom logic in Lambda, basically, to deliver software again faster than ever, scales, you know, effortlessly, and only charges you whenever it runs. That just felt like this has got to be where the cloud's heading, right? This has got to be as you know, the natural level of efficiency that's coming to the cloud. And so, but at that time, there was no story for doing that. There was like Lambda came out. It was really weird. There were a few limited use cases like you were talking about. It was so early. And I kept kind of, I waited around for a couple of months. I was like, come on, someone's got to be doing this. And I didn't see anything come out that really made this vision of this new architecture real and accessible. And that's what drove me to make the serverless framework. It was kind of a scratch my own itch scenario. You know, I worked on it Sunday mornings in the coffee shop, just hacking away and you know, definitely side project, right? I'm like this, I'm going to spend this much time on this project, you know, every single Sunday morning. And it was called Joss in the beginning, and it had this cool shark mascot, and the tagline was the monstrously scalable serverless framework with really kind of cool shark. And I put it out there. I almost didn't post it anywhere, but I was going off to lunch and I kind of put it on Hacker News before I went off to get a sandwich or something. And I came back and it had just blown up, you know, and it's just like one of those incredible things. I hope everybody has an opportunity to experience something like that with something that they've made, where you just see people kind of gravitate towards it organically, you know, without any paid marketing or anything like that. And it was like, you know, going for a casual stroll and you kind of kick over a rock and all this oil comes gushing out. There's, you know, just it's hard to explain. But developers loved it. And that was kind of the beginning of the serverless framework. We had some challenges around the trademark with Jaws, the shark icon. And when I say we, it was really just me because I'm working on this myself, you know, not making any money off of it or anything. And all of a sudden, we had some copyright infringement warning letters, and we knew we had to do a name change. And it really broke my heart to do that because I really loved that initial branding. But it wasn't clear that serverless was the category or would even be a category. It was just something that was fun to say. But I grew up around Los Angeles, around Hollywood, and I was always around people who are screenwriters and directors, and they're just like any other engineer, but they engineer for emotional impact. They're looking for how do I construct scenes, you know, broader narratives, and place the camera to get people to lean in and get engaged in the story, empathize with characters, and you know, build something that's emotionally resonant. And I've always kind of taken those lessons to the products I build because I think you have to design them for emotional impact as well. And so when I was out there in the early days talking to people about this, it was the serverless buzzword that I would say that to developers and I just watched them light up, you know, and I couldn't explain it. I think they just loved hearing that word because serverless was kind of this general description for everything that they didn't really want to deal with. Right? They just wanted to build, you know, typically they don't like to maintain a lot of things. And I was just noticing that. I'm always looking for, you know, when are people leaning in or they start nodding, you know, sort of like unconsciously to some degree. Because that's, you know, that's the things you really want to focus in on. And it was the serverless buzzword. So it took a little while to see if we can get the domain. And again, so early, a lot of people were saying, this is a silly name. This is a weird name. Like, why would you call it serverless? You know, and I'm like, well, it's about as technically accurate as the cloud, right? In terms of like, you know, a adjective. But the emotional response when you tell that to a developer is so real. So we changed everything. Once it was clear, I can get the domain, changed everything to serverless framework and created serverless.com. And then we were off to the races. And and the vision in those early days was like, let's build this framework for this new serverless kind of managed service architecture. And, you know, so what happened shortly after that was AWS started pouring a lot of budget on this category, right? They really liked this. And in many ways, you know, there's a lot of us kind of stumbling into this major technology category that I think AWS adopted as like, this has got to be top three strategic priorities over the next 10 years for us, because we think, you know, we could really lead cloud in general through the serverless category. And so in the early days, it was like, the goal for me was always, we want to support all managed services, you know, be open to all vendors, developers, you know, not so much need to switch things around, but they need to have freedom of choice. They need to be able to take the best of breed products. And there should be one universal experience for doing that, composing these things from any vendor into an architecture that's just kind of wrapped in great developer experience. And but AWS came on very strong and invested so aggressively in the serverless category and continued to come out with incredible serverless infrastructure as a service and improvements to Lambda, things like API Gateway, and already having things like S3 and whatnot. That we, the serverless framework, really just focused in kind of on the AWS architecture. And it was, you know, together, I think, you know, with us kind of showing that there was a real architecture here and making it accessible to developers, and with the strength of AWS's marketing budget and their investment and belief in this space too, and have to give them all the credit in the world for coming up with Lambda and whatnot. But I think that's kind of the story in general of the serverless framework and in many ways the serverless category.
Yeah, the stuff that AWS has been doing the last 10 years has been pretty amazing in terms of the amount of, you know, services and features that they continue to pump out even now. I think there have just been quite a few pretty big announcements just before reInvent. The Lambda has got this new logging capabilities. And I think I saw recently as well, the Amplifiers has also been pushing quite a few features out for server-side rendering and a few other things as well. And I guess by the time people listening to this, it's already after reInvent, so I'm sure lots of other things that probably have got announced during reInvent as well. And I'm still surprised, you know, I guess slightly by the fact that Google is still very much focusing on the, you know, the container story. I know Google Cloud Run has got, you know, it's quite interesting in terms of, you know, being a serverless container workload and being able to run containers fairly, I guess, you know, with low effort. And AWS has got Fargate for that as well. But Microsoft has also been doing a lot of work towards their functions as service offering. But I still feel that in terms of the whole package, AWS is still quite a bit ahead. Certainly in terms of you know, having IAM, and that's a really core piece that I think is missing right now in the Azure and also in GCP as well. I guess going back to the serverless framework, obviously you guys announced that version 4 is going to come out sometime in the 2024. And there's been some really big changes that's been announced already in terms of there's going to be a pricing structure. So that for companies that are obviously making more than $2 million a year in the revenue, they have to start paying for some features, as also there's going to be a new extensions, which is, the next iteration of plugins, if I understand correctly. And I think you also in the launch blog post, there was a mention of some ways for you to easily switch between, it's the containers and Lambda or Fargate and Lambda, so that you can easily port your workload from, say, a Lambda function to running in Fargate instead, and maybe vice versa. So I guess for folks who are wondering about what's going to happen with the server framework v4, and I know a few customers has asked me about, okay, what are your thoughts on the coming changes to the server framework because of the pricing change? And so I guess I want to just get your take on, get your side of the story, you know, why the changes, what are we going to be getting with the server v4, and tell us about why you guys are making this move, and what does it mean to customers?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we talked a bit about kind of the origin, you know, in our background and whatnot, you know, which you were certainly experiencing firsthand as well. And you know, maybe we could actually jump into like where we are now today, you know? So, you know, just starting with the serverless framework, we've come a long way, and we've been at this for 9 years, which is a very long amount of time in tech years. I'm sure you can relate. Like it's a long time. And the framework has been this incredible success story. We have had millions of developers building millions of serverless applications, and the framework continues to grow, you know, year over year at a phenomenal rate. And the best part of it for me personally is that now there have been kind of dozens of companies that have been kind of founded, you know, with a big focus on just using serverless architectures and serverless framework, who have achieved unicorn valuations and have even exited or IPO'd with, you know, smaller teams largely just using the serverless framework. And, you know, some of these are like electric vehicle companies, some of these are social media companies, some of these are new publications. And I totally confess, we don't do a good enough job in telling these stories. But there's no better proof in the framework, and especially the movement and the underlying infrastructure as a service, that this is so powerful, than hearing these stories of people starting with nothing, you know, very few resources, achieving these, you know, astronomic valuations and exiting successfully. Like this, yeah, this is the stuff that gets me out of bed in the morning, right? It's just like, after all this time, you could really see the impact. Plus, in the majority of Fortune 500 companies, you'll see serverless framework kind of in there somewhere, you know, no doubt. So the framework has been this phenomenal story. And then frankly, in many ways, I can't explain it. You know, from that first day of posting all the way to today, the growth continues, and we haven't spent, you know, really any money on marketing. We really haven't sponsored any conferences. We're not on social media, you know, really, you know, talking about this too much. And so it's just this thing in many ways I can't fully explain. And then there's so. You know, excited, you know, feeling happy about that. And then, but then there's the serverless movement today. And on that side, it's like, I don't know about you, but I'm not feeling like we've had the success that we were hoping for. And when I go back to that, like, original vision of like this world where you have all these managed services and like an easy universal developer experience to compose these together, harness them and build applications, you know, with low overhead, faster and more easily than ever. I don't know. I haven't seen that really come to fruition. And, you know, certainly serverless framework, we haven't gotten very far on that. We've really just kind of doubled down on the AWS focus, you know, for a large part. And it's still, personally for me, it feels like there's a lot left to do there. But on the movement, it's like, well, first off, on the upside, I think there's a ton of new vendors in the serverless space, which is amazing. This is exactly what I was hoping. I was like, you know, serverless is what we expect from new infrastructure as a service, right? And so there needs to be a new class of infrastructure as a service offerings that come to the market that are serverless first. And we're seeing that. Databases, caches, all types of stuff. When people go to market these days, like, you'll see their initial landing page is going to say serverless on it somewhere if they're offering infrastructure as a service. And that's so cool. Like that's, you know, that's what it's all about. More, you know, more of those. These are the greatest building blocks of all time. Let's get as much of this, as much of these as possible to developers. But there's still challenges in the workflow. And these challenges have been around forever, which motivated, you know, me to start the serverless framework. And that is, this is a new type of architecture. A lot of things that you used to code yourself, you're outsourcing it to these services. And you have to figure out how to compose them together, develop them. What does that experience look like locally on the cloud? How do you deploy them? How do you test them? You know, how do you scale the project? How do you organize the project so that it can scale? How do you observe them? You know, how do you debug them? You know, it's a new type of architecture. And looking at it now, I think that the workflow is still fairly problematic, which is a barrier to entry for a lot of folks. And I don't feel like we've done a good enough job there. The DX still is good, but you know, now there's just a lot of serverless services. Lambda itself is pretty complex, right? There's a lot of knobs and levers alone just on Lambda. And you have a lot of different serverless services I didn't expect would come out. That would be part of this, where it's like, okay, like I really want an API to do this, but we kind of end up with APIs to do a lot of different things that, you know, are interesting too, but there's just more. There's more. And so this DX problem is kind of getting compounded with all these, you know, these new serverless services. And, you know, some of these new vendors want to bake in the workflow into their products. Like they want to own the whole workflow too, because it's a, you know, it's very compelling if you could offer workflow and the infrastructure as a service, you know, together. But in many ways, that results in a more fragmented development story. And I see a lot of the fragmentation right now, more than ever. You know, I see it in the serverless space. I see it in the, you know, developer tooling space in general, just a ton of complexity, ton of fragmentation. And then we still had some challenges. We still have some same old complaints around lock-in, you know, which I feel like that's a hard one. We could improve some things there though. In general, I feel like it feels like Kubernetes and containers still sucked up a lot of the oxygen in the room, you know, despite our best efforts, you know, but they still are getting a lot of attention. And then furthermore, today we've got these cost concerns and a lot of reasons for those, but I'll say, you know, serverless framework, we get a lot of requests from users about reducing costs at this point. And is that because they just have so many serverless services kind of, and they're in this kind of layered scenario of costs that they didn't really anticipate in the early days? A lot of these people have really mature workloads that have super high volume, consistent kind of high volumes. And they're like, okay, well, it feels like we could run this more efficiently now, potentially. And then it's a new economy, right? Higher interest rates. We were talking about that earlier before we started, but that, you know, that changes everything. Suddenly, you know, controlling costs is more important than ever. So, and there's just been a lot of kind of stories about serverless costs, you know, just being too expensive, cloud costs in general being too expensive. Anyway, so looking back at the movement, I think the framework would come a long way. The serverless movement, personally, I still feel like we have a ways to go. You know, some people in the serverless community are saying it's a win. Serverless has just become cloud. Like this is how it's always meant to be. But I don't know. I still feel like we have a long ways to go here. And, you know, frankly, if a new developer is starting, I'm not even sure the best place to point them towards in general to kind of get going in this new ecosystem. So a lot of the changes that we're going to talk about with serverless framework are really motivated by us looking around thinking, is this as far as we can go with this? You know, is there more that we could do here? Because I feel that there is. And, you know, I've been in this from the beginning because I just felt like there was a lot more that we could do. I'm curious though, since you've been here in the space for such a long time, what are your feelings on the movement and where we're at right now?
Yeah, so certainly I think, like you mentioned, there's still a lot of friction in terms of someone can, you know, trying to do serverless stuff, having no previous experience with using AWS or using serverless components. There's a really big mindset change they have to go through. A lot of the practices that they're used to doesn't really quite work with you know, when you're doing serverless development, and probably even more than that, it's the fact that you really have to design your applications differently And so, you know, it's taking a lot of the existing workloads to serverless usually means quite a bit of you know, re-architecting, making certain decisions, but also adopting your practices as well. Things like over-reliance on running everything locally and making technical technical choices that basically means, oh, I have to run SQLite or whatever on your machine to be able to run everything locally, to be able to run tests. And part of what I've been doing is developing all of these practices that kind of merge local development with remote testing, and so that they're coming out with a set of practices and processes that makes it easy for you to develop, but at the same time, kind of taking advantage of the fact that with Lambda and all of these serverless services, you can deploy a lot of them and not paying anything, because you only pay for them when they run. So you can have a temporary environment. And that's one of the probably most impactful practices you can adopt when doing serverless development, the ability to just bring up a new environment when you're working on something, make your changes there, test against that environment, and then tear it down when you are done with the feature work or whatever. So it solves a lot of the problems. But at the same time, there's a lot of developers coming into this space, and you know, they have to learn a whole new set of services, because when you come to, when you said serverless is the cloud, so to use the cloud, you have to learn 5, maybe 10 services just so that you have you know what to do for API, you know what to do for doing PubSub, you know what to do for building event-driven architectures. So all of these things, it means you have to learn a service for doing for a particular kind of architecture. Which means suddenly you're looking at a lot of customers there. They have to take on a lot of new things in one go. I work with a lot of enterprises where they it's not the fact that they have to learn how to use Lambda, but it's the fact that they have to understand how AWS works, how the cloud security and the shared responsibility model works. They need to understand how Lambda works, but then they have to also learn how to use API Gateway, DynamoDB, NoSQL databases, and they have to learn EventBridge and maybe 5 other things just to be able to do everything they are doing already by running all of the server components that are self-hosting all of this stuff themselves. So on the one hand, yes, once you understand how all of that works, it's a really powerful thing. I mean, nowadays I can take on client work. I can do everything myself in a fraction of the time that it used to take an entire team of people to do. So in terms of being able to, get a lot more done with less, fewer people and fewer resources, it's absolutely amazing what you can do. But the premises is that you have to have people who knows what they're doing, who knows how serverless stuff work and how to design and build serverless architectures. And getting there is not easy. And also, it's really easy to make mistakes that's going to have a big cost impact, because in the cloud, every decision you make is a buying decision. Using the wrong service can mean the massive difference. Using API Gateway when you've got a really high throughput API, that's going to cost you an arm and a leg compared to using AOB. And not having the right caching in place also means that your Lambda function may just be running a lot, and that can be a problem. Same goes to pretty much everything you're doing. Once you have to think about scale and cost efficiency, there's a lot of things where you just think, okay, that's a lot of places where people can shoot themselves in the foot. So a lot of what I've been doing has the last couple of years has just been focusing on, teaching people about those caveats. It's not easy to talk about, because there's no one answer. You can never give just one answer. It's always if this, then that, and then you have to kind of factor in all of these different contexts people have, and that's kind of what's so I find.
And that answer is going to change in about a week when reInvent happens.
Exactly. And every time they make a change to the services, to the pricing models, or to something, you have to kind of adapt your answer again. It's really fast changing space, and it's fun, but also at the same time it can be exhausting. And if it's difficult for me, who's basically do this full time, it's just gonna be really difficult and impossible for people who's got a full time job. They're gonna do something else and build their products as well.
Oh yeah, complexity. We're facing growing complexity. in this movement in general. And, you know, it's, I think it's, that's an opportunity though for developer tools. That's an opportunity, you know, for us and what's motivating these changes. It's like, you know what, we've got new challenges. There's new challenges in the movement. We think though it could go a lot further, and it's up to a great developer tool, like in the beginning, to really make this more accessible to folks and attain that complexity. And, that's what brought us into making some big changes, you know, with V4, effectively. So, and if I were to kind of bucket those changes, it's basically, it's a new model, but it's a new model for us as a company. But it's also a new model for infrastructure as code. Because we've learned a lot about building infrastructure as code projects over the years. And so we're going to explore some new models, you know, with that as well. But, you know, starting with for us, you know, transparently, we're actually a small company. You know, we haven't raised incredible amounts of cash, you know, like a lot of other companies in the space. And, you know, I have us on track to be profitable. Like that's the goal for us, right? It's the most important thing right now. A lot of macro uncertainty out there. Like, you know, let's just build a long-term kind of profitable company. And, you know, one of the things that's always been really hard for us, you know, with serverless framework is where the incentives are. The incentives previously have been in, well, we give away this open source framework and we try and monetize elsewhere. So basically, like, you kind of find product market fit on something, and then you have to go find product market fit on something else and commercialize that. And I think that's just been a big challenge for kind of open source companies in general. You know, it's not exclusive to us. But I think it just goes back to incentives. You know, that at the end of the day, if your incentives aren't around kind of the big project, the big product that people are using, over time, you know, you'll lose focus on it, or you won't, you know, maintain it as well and whatnot. And this isn't just a simple product. You know, building out infrastructure as code products in particular, it requires an ungodly amount of energy and resources, right? Like, it is an incredible amount of work. You have to burn a ton of calories to keep that thing going. And I'll talk about that in a sec, but for us, it's pretty clear. We just have to fix the incentives. Like, what are we doing? You know, what do we really believe in? And how do we just make sure that we're focusing on that, you know, the whole time? And the answer is serverless framework for us. That's what we started with. That's what we want to continue on. And it's what we want to use to approach a lot of these new challenges. So we are doing some changes in the upcoming version of serverless framework. These will only affect serverless framework V4 and beyond. But the big change in there is that we'll be charging for those future versions if you're a company that makes over $2 million in annual revenue. So if you're a solopreneur or a startup, if you haven't hit that mark, you don't have to pay anything. It's very similar to what Docker's done in a lot of ways. And we're charging based on instances, basically for serverless framework, that's kind of synonymous with CloudFormation stacks and kind of like a grouping of infrastructure. If you look at how a lot of the infrastructure as code companies are pricing these days, it's, you know, they might be selling a dashboard, they might be selling via users, but a lot of them increasingly are selling around resources managed by the infrastructure as code project. And we looked at that and it's like kind of confusing. It's like, it's resources managed by the project per hour. So you have to figure out, like, okay, how many resources is this project managing? And then, you know, across how many hours, basically. And that felt a little too complicated. So we wanted to simplify it with just charging around the instance, aka kind of the serverless.yaml across different stages. And the goal is to sustain, number one. These projects take a lot of work and effort to maintain reliability. And for infrastructure as code in particular, like, you really want that thing to allow you to continue to deploy over time. And improve quality all across the board, but then innovate like never before. And these changes are, you know, definitely different, you know, for us, But I'll tell you, already we have more people in Serverless Framework than we've had in years. We've got more massive roadmap items than we've had in years. We've got a whole bunch of quality fixes, you know, including just a nice support offering that comes built in and much better reliability across the board. And it just feels like everything, frankly, you know, we should have done a long time ago. And so we're pumped about this. It's definitely a big change for our users and whatnot. And then also on the infrastructure as code side, you know, we've learned a lot about IAC models and, again, how many resources it takes to keep these things going. And it's not just about getting started, because it's very easy to say in the beginning, oh, we figured it all out. We've got self-sustaining open source community, and this is the way it's going to work forever. It really comes down to over time. How do you sustain stuff, a project like that, over time when there's new vendors, there's new services, and the configuration is expanding and changing, you know, across all those. It's a massive, massive surface area. In fact, I think it seems like it's been really hard to do infrastructure as code without corporate backing. Like, I can't think of any big infrastructure as code projects that that are purely open source without kind of company, you know, or some other kind of financial support, you know, coming from somewhere. I mean, the nature of like infrastructure as code is just, it's just really hard, especially if you want to sustain that over time. And even with the corporate backed projects, there's a lot of challenges there. Looking around at the landscape today, there's sort of this Russian doll effect with infrastructure as code projects, where it's like, it seems like Terraform, I think it has some Ansible components, and then Pulumi has parts of Terraform in it. And then like a bunch of startups are being built on CDK. We're built on CloudFormation. And right, so we're kind of like all of a sudden reusing each other's stuff a lot. And then all of a sudden you throw in this new trend of anti-competitive licenses into that. And that feels like, I mean, this all of a sudden is really fragile, right? And then you have, you know, the big vendors like AWS and CloudFormation, which, you know, is great and reliable and fantastic in a lot of ways. Though I had always hoped for more innovation from CloudFormation personally. I just, you know, since we started with CloudFormation in 2015, there's been so many things that we've always wanted it to do that we've never seen. And I get it. It's hard to do CloudFormation at its scale and innovate, you know, on top of that. And then, of course, like, it's only AWS focused, right? So some challenges there. Okay, great. CloudFormation reliable, but you have to be, you know, mostly all in on AWS. And that was never my personal hope as a developer. I feel strongly about developers have to be able to choose the best of breed services to build the best products, right? Like, you know, AWS, very competent, but still, you're going to want to use Stripe. Or the most recent example, I mean, we'll see. There's a lot of drama around this company as we record this, but like, if you're doing AI, like, you want to use, you know, GPT-4, right? Like, that's like, you know, that unlocks so many new possibilities and whatnot. So preserving the ability for companies and developers to be able to choose the best of breed things to build the best product, I think, is really important. And then I've also noticed that AWS has actually spread itself really thin. So they're not just doing one IAC, they've got a few takes on it. Right. And so it's interesting. It's like, well, they have a big company that have infinite resources, but it changes when they do a lot of the different variations of the same thing. Because if you do a lot of variations of infrastructure as code in particular, like, it, again, takes ungodly amounts of energy and resources to keep IAC projects going. And then if you spread yourself thin across, you know, CloudFormation and SAM and CDK and CDK across multiple languages and whatnot, like, there's a lot there to maintain over time. So this, you know, it's been hard to see how to do IAC self-sustaining, you know, without corporate backing. And then in the corporate backed project space, there's a lot of, it doesn't seem perfect to me in particular. And Serverless Framework, you know, we've had our fair share of challenges here with our plugin ecosystem. And we have over 1,000 plugins that come with Serverless Framework that allow you to do all types of new use cases and or kind of add new workflow capabilities to the framework, but those plugins aren't always maintained. And so it's hard for people to figure out, okay, what's, you know, what's interesting or what's working, you know, still today. And, you know, again, for a lot of us, it was like, I think we had a core incentive problem, you know, which we're switching here. But also, I think that there's probably enough evidence here to say, like, we should maybe explore new ways to do infrastructure as code and, you know, ways to sustain this. And that's also a big motivator for the changes in V4, because we're basically bringing a creator economy model to infrastructure as code. And that comes in the form of one of, like, many of the V4's upcoming innovations, but it's extensions. And so that is, you know, we'll see. It's new. It's ambitious. But if it, you know, if it works and it takes off, I think it'll have a broad effect on the infrastructure as code space, potentially.
Yeah. I guess one of the things you mentioned is just the fact that AWS has got so many different infrastructures as code tools. And one of the things that I think Ben Cahill keeps talking about is that over the last couple of years, AWS has been very focused on fixing problems on the client side, you know, fixing problems by using, you know, using CDK or SAM as opposed to addressing some of the root issues at the CloudFormation level. And I think you know, that's one of the things that we finally see CloudFormation support or have a better support for adding or importing resources into an existing into a stack. That's something that's been, right. I guess people have been waiting for that for years now.
Are you talking about the recent change, like this week?
Yeah. This week, yeah. That new feature to make it easier for you to import resources into a stack without having to create some manual JSON manifest. So that's been a really welcome change. And honestly, probably one of the only updates, meaningful update in CloudFormation besides support for new services. And I think we should, you know, they are getting better now to release a new service with CloudFormation support. After, I guess, people like Ben Cahill just been shaming them and for years.
he's good at that.
Yeah. So I definitely see that's an interesting issue. And also with Sam, I guess, you know, for a few years, it felt like SAM was going, you know, by the wayside. They were focusing so much on CDK, but now recently they've actually switched their focus back into SAM and got some new people into the team, and they've been releasing quite a few new features recently. And we also have, like I said, we got this layers of tools that build on each other. You've got at the base level, you've got CloudFormation and Terraform, and then you've got tools that build on top of that. And then you've got things like SST, which is built on top of CDK, which is built on top of CloudFormation. So, you know, you've got all these different tools that build on top of each other. But at the very bottom layer, you know, we really need to see more things being done to CloudFormation to improve it, so that we have, you know, core features that are being implemented in the service layer as opposed to trying to fix it into the in the client level, where every single client has doing something slightly differently, and it's really hard to, like, one of the things I keep saying to the SAM team is that it's great that, you know, you guys are building some of this tooling, but then it's only going to benefit people that are using SAM. It's not going to benefit anyone who's using, say, server framework or using CDK or some other tool. And still, even with things like CDK and SAM, I still think that, you know, for people that are focused more on the backend side of things or DevOps engineers, you know, that they're probably, you know, good enough, but there's a whole world of front end developers who are not that familiar with AWS. They don't want to have to learn all of this nitty-gritty stuff. They just want to have something that's easy, that, you know, that gives them the benefit of using serverless technologies without having to learn all the nitty-gritties of you know, how Lambda works and all of that. And that's where things have a sell and then, you know, are so popular, is because they've done a good job of abstracting away, you know, the AWS components under the hood. But they're also quite pricey at any sort of reasonable level of scale. So it's been really interesting to see that whole space. And I guess that's where, you know, I'm interested to see what Jeremy is going to do with AMPT and you know, what they're going to do is in terms of just, you know, abstracting away that the underlying complexities of AWS so that more people can get into this space and get a benefit of, you know, serverless technologies without having to understand all the different minute details that you have to sort of learn and understand before you, otherwise you're going to shoot yourself in the foot. But yeah, so I'm really interested to hear about these new extensions and whether and how it's different from plugins. I understand the revenue share model, and I really do hope that addresses in some way the problem we see with open source fatigue, where maintainers don't really get the credit for the work they do. They all they have to do is just, you know, a bunch of people complaining about, oh, this is not working, that's not working. And you know, all the while we are relying on people to put in free labor to maintain projects that we use for commercial reasons. I really do think that there needs to be some, the whole model needs to change. You can't just rely on people to do, you know, to volunteer and put in the labor for free when you are benefiting commercially and financially. So tell us about these extensions. How is it different from plugins? And also, how does the sort of revenue share model work in terms of how does it count towards which part of how much of the revenue from someone paying for using serverless framework goes towards someone who's created a popular extension?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and real quick, everything I'm saying, I don't want to. I'm not here to say in any way open source is broken or anything. I mean, who am I? But that doesn't make any sense. Open source is obviously one of the greatest kind of most virtuous things that humanity has done. You know, coordinating people at such a massive scale on a voluntary basis. Like, what are the analogs for that? Like, this is totally unprecedented and incredible. And if there's going to be a highlight reel of humanity, you know, at the very end of things, like, open source is going to be there on that somewhere, right? I mean, it's an incredible model, but you know, the burnout, the fatigue is real, you know, and it's especially real when your focus is like, well, we're provisioning and updating cloud infrastructure and stuff. I mean, it might not be the most exciting thing, right, to keep going there. And you know, what we see a lot, you know, frankly, is 95% of projects, you know, like plugins or something, like, aren't maintained after 3 years. And then, but more importantly, like, after the first year, I'd say 95%, and this might be a rule for open source, I don't have any data on this, but this is all observational, but like, seems like 95% after the first year, the innovation is kind of done. Like, there's just fatigue. It's like, this cake is baked. We'll just do bug fixes and security patches and stuff. And it's tough, because again, you're potentially picking up a lot of broken stuff. And we've had this, you know, in serverless framework with the plugin model for a long time. And so we're trying to change that, figure out a new model here. So the difference here is extensions are designed around adding new use cases. So new capabilities to the framework, deploying, you know, whatever, front-end use cases, static websites, real-time data processing pipelines, these back-end use cases, different types of deploying, different ways of deploying APIs and whatnot. So really kind of new use cases that the framework doesn't support already. And they could be anything, frankly. You know, we'd like to think that based on our community and what they like, it'll be built on serverless services. But anyone could build one of these. And because we're charging for the framework, which is, you know, a tough transition, it does unlock new possibilities. And so we thought, like, hey, what if we explored this creator economy model and we shared 80% of the revenue of people using those extensions with the author? And so, like, who would this be for? Well, you know, indie hackers looking for passive income. You know, when I go on Twitter, especially my Twitter feed, probably your Twitter feed, it's a bunch of these, like, super scrappy, cool like AWS hackers, like, building all these cool scripts and things for automating all the stuff, right? They're building these little projects, and I always look at them and I'm like, oh, that looks great. You know, I want to use it. I hope it lasts over time. And there's a bunch of them that I used to use that are gone now. And there's just this huge community around people who, you know, developers who build these basically micro developer experiences. And, you know, I think if there was a way that people could maybe get some passive income, you know, from that, and without having to do things like, raise awareness, all the hard parts of like getting a new product to market, you know, raising awareness, like building, you know, a community around it, and you know, all the marketing that has to go into it. So Serverless Framework has incredible distribution. Like if you, it's the, oh, is this my portrait mode thumbs up thing that keeps happening? I've got the portrait mode Mac OS Sonoma upgrade that like, whenever I do a thumbs up, it does a little like computer animated emoji thing. Anyway, so for indie hackers looking for passive income, if they had an easy way to go to market, you know, with this stuff and access Serverless Framework's distribution. So we're probably the biggest base of AWS Lambda users and serverless users outside of AWS itself, right? It's a very qualified group of people who spend real money on projects, right? And so to be able to tap into them easily, and we'd love to promote this stuff. I mean, this model's only going to work, you know, if we're doing this together, you know, with the creators and whatnot. So, so to have instant access to the Serverless Framework community, plug it in, and just focus on building the product, right? Like, let us help with the promotion. You know, we'll make discovery really easy, and you just focus on building the best possible kind of micro DX for whatever it is, provisioning something, you know, some type of use case, typically, right? So for them, I think it's really interesting. It's something I wish I had when I created Serverless Framework, because my route was like, oh, geez, there's a lot of traction here. What do I do? Do I raise venture capital, you know, go on that trajectory, you know, build a company around that, which has been an amazing and awesome journey. But I think there should be a second option, you know, for folks, especially in this new world, this new economy, like, hey, just go to market really easily with your DX, right? And also for independent software vendors, if they have like a new serverless infrastructure offering, it would be so fantastic just to tap into Serverless Framework's community and just offer an easy deployment kind of update, you know, infrastructure as code scenario within that community. I think this is great for them. And consulting firms who are building these repeatable use cases over and over again for their clients, you know, for them to be able to offer that to clients and then kind of open it up to, you know, the broader community to use and maybe make some passive income off that. I think it's really interesting. Now, this is early and it's highly speculative, but we took some of the big plugins and we looked at the data and we're like, well, how much would these make in the extension model? And the top plugins would make over 60K ARR, and which is pretty good. You know, super interesting there. So it's a new take, hopefully better quality, more sustainability over time. And it really helps us build community in a way that we haven't done before. And I will say we got inspired by this a lot from Terraform and the recent license changes. So we're talking a bit about the anti-competitive license changes in the industry right now. And I knew when Terraform came out with that change that we were going to make this transition to, you know, having fees with the new version of Serverless Framework. And I was looking at what Terraform was doing. And for me, it was a strategy of excluding, like excluding community, excluding kind of people. And I thought like, well, if we are charging fees, is there a way that we could actually have a strategy of being more inclusive? Like what could we do? You know, yes, we have to charge, but like what opportunities does this unlock? And, that was that Terraform experience that really got me thinking around like, hey, let's try and design something where we're not shutting anyone out. We're trying to get everyone to participate, right? And let's see if we could build something, you know, bigger than ever with this approach that we could all kind of share in the success of. And so that's kind of the high level goals of extensions. At the low level though, they're just containers actually. So you build an extension in a container, which is different from a lot of the approaches we've taken in the past, because we've actually tried to approach kind of new ways of building infrastructure as code modules since the beginning. If you go look at the JAWS framework stuff and look up like AWS SM, AWS modules, like you'll see maybe some old graphics or something from our first take on how to like modularize and build these new infrastructure as code developer experiences. We've been at this for a long time. We had a lot of opinions. This is the first time, though, that we've had no opinion, frankly. And that comes in the form of containers. So it does not matter what vendor you want your extension to deploy to. You could use any vendor, right? You could use any language, right? This could be written in anything. And you could also use any existing framework. If you just want to build something that already uses CloudFormation or CDK, you know, or something else, you could bring that into your container. You know, at the end of the day, extensions will be things that people add to their serverless.yaml, and they'll be able to use them programmatically as well. And we abstract spinning up these containers and calling them and passing data into them, you know, getting data out and passing that into other extensions. And it's just the simple, boring technology containers that makes this all possible. And I mean, you can even bring some existing thing that you've already built and port it over into a container pretty easily as well. And so it's a very, this is what I was hoping to show off today, but hopefully we get a chance to dig into the demo in just a couple of weeks. I think we're a couple of weeks away from bringing on the authors. But it's a very interesting take on all this that offers like total flexibility, plus benefits of, you know, isolation, better isolation with containers, better consistency, kind of better security model than I think we've had before. And ultimately it gets us back to that vision of a universal experience for deploying managed services, serverless services across vendors in a uniform way. Any use case, anything is possible. Let's be as inclusive as we can, regardless of language and vendor and all that stuff. And there's a lot of what we started off, what I started off hoping the serverless framework would offer is kind of baked into this extensions vision with this new, you know, with this new interesting revenue share model. And today we've got well over 100 extensions. We've barely talked about them. We kind of put that, a little snippet in that blog post around before, but we have over 100 extensions registered already, and they look awesome. I look at the list and I think, like, if just two of these got built, it would be such a game changer, right? Because it's like so many of these things that people want already, our users want, that we can't get to, you know. But if just like two of those on the list got built, it would be such a dramatic improvement for people using serverless framework.
Is the list of extensions already publicly available so that anyone can go and have a look and see what they, you know, what extensions are going to be there?
Not yet.
Okay.
Working on the registry. Our first goal is like we're going to nail the authoring experience, right? It's a new way of kind of using containers to, you know, for IAC, and so that's taken a lot of cool innovation. You know, frankly, what we decided to do is like, yeah, we're using containers. We want to abstract that as much as possible. You know, people shouldn't have to think about the container as much. And so we've really built this nice experience over that. And so we're wrapping that up and we're sending that out. So we allow people to register extensions. So in that, in the blog post for V4, we said, you could register, in our initial registry right now and like get a namespace. And so we have a list kind of privately in our database of people who signed up to build things. So that's what we've been looking at, but we'll open that up. I think we're going to send out the authoring kind of kit to folks. We're going to make that public in a couple of weeks. And then we'll probably have the registry done in like a month. It's the holidays. We'll see. But then things will be public.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah, because when I looked at the blog post, it was not clear exactly how the extension mechanism is going to work. But sounds like it's similar to the existing plugin system. There's going to be a life cycle in terms of when the framework is going to invoke your extension, and your extension can do whatever you want to do in your code, but then can still modify the CloudFormation template that's been generated, so you can do some of the things that the current plugin system can do. Would that be the case?
We're working on how to modify the existing CloudFormation template. You know, first right now, that's not going to be offered just yet. It is, you know, create another CloudFormation stack within your extension. You know, for example, it would be a simple way to kind of get around that. But a whole bunch of data, ARNs, things like that will be easily passed into from the framework so that you can reference a lot of things on your account easily and use those in the new CloudFormation stack, for example. Recreating the plugin model, you know, with these new technologies has been definitely a challenge, but we've got some good workarounds for that initially.
Okay. Yeah, because that's one of the I guess that's one of the common use cases for a plugin, is to kind of almost like a macro, but then the I guess the lighter weight. You don't have to deploy to CloudFormation to do that. You can just have your own plugin that modifies your CloudFormation template locally before you before you send it off to CloudFormation. And there's some really clever things you can do. And I've seen so many, I've used so many plugins in the past that does things that makes life so much easier. The one that I use pretty much always is the service layers plugin, which kind of packages my deployment, look at my dependencies, see if they change. If not, then if they change, then they create a new layer version and update all my functions in the CloudFormation template to reference this layer that it just automatically publishes for you. So it gives you all the benefits of using layers without having to manage that yourself. Okay. So looking forward to what the extensions is going to look like. I'm probably going to be trying it out myself and maybe put one or two cheeky extensions out there myself. Another thing that you mentioned in the blog post was this ability to easily switch between containers and fast. I guess, again, the details is a bit light on the blog post. Is there anything you can tell us about how that's going to look like? Is that because one of the things that people are doing nowadays to kind of achieve that portability is to use patterns like hexagonal architectures, where you write your code in a certain way, modularize them in a certain way, so that when you want to switch between, say, running Lambda functions versus having Express JS app or something running the Fargate, you don't have to rewrite all of your domain logic and just reuse all of that. So how does what did you call it? Container and fast switching? Fast and container switching. How does that look?
Yeah, so we're actually using the new extension technology for this. But go back on the problems to solve originally with what's going on with the serverless movement today. Again, we're getting hit with a lot of cost concerns around the board, right? And people wanting to just move over to Fargate, frankly, for a lot of high volume, consistent workloads. And they want that experience to be really easy. And I think the cost concerns have been amplified so much that, I don't know, there's almost this sense of we shouldn't do serverless at all. But that makes no sense, because serverless is still the best option in town by far if you're looking to get to market at very little cost, right? Get ideas out there as fast as you can with very little administration and kind of cost required. I think the missing piece is just how do we, once you achieve certain levels of scale, how do you easily kind of move between, something like Fargate, and Lambda in particular. And these underlying technologies have changed a lot. I'm sure you remember that I don't know if it's still ongoing, but the serverless versus containers debate, forever, right? And but now Lambda runs containers, and it looks like the performance of containers is actually, comparable, if not in some cases, due to some sophisticated caching, better than zip files, on AWS Lambda. So suddenly, running containers on Lambda is viable. I also think one of the big challenges for the serverless architecture in general is not really participating, maybe excluding the container workflow too much, which has been adopted broadly by so many organizations, and not fitting nicely into those standard workflows. So we do have a project coming out that's focused on deploying containers to Lambda and easily switching between Fargate as well as Cloud Run. And you could also bring in Edge Compute as a proxy in front of all that. And still in the works in terms of how we're going to pull it off, and dependent on potentially new features coming out at reInvent this year. So, which will change the game. It's, serverless containers are, I think, continue to get more serverless. It seems like Lambda actually gets more serverful in a lot of ways, but with that comes the opportunity to have more flexibility, right? I think it's now in the hands of a developer tool to give you the right opinions on how to start from day one, so that you always maintain that ability to flexibly deploy to either of these and switch, you know, back and forth. And so, yeah, it's early. We'll probably get the prototype out in January, but I think this is something like this is what the serverless movement could really use right now to solve potentially some of these cost concerns. And the way we think about it internally is it's time for a serverless architecture version 2, right? Like what could this, you know, how can we make this better? We got these new challenges. You know, what are we going to do in the face of these challenges? It's like, well, I think it's time to revisit the architecture and say like, yeah, let's try and get all the existing benefits of serverless and then, you know, make it easy to kind of switch over to containerized options and whatnot when you have hit that level of scale or you're just at that point in your journey where for whatever reason that makes sense. And then we're throwing in some stuff like having that standard experience for Lambda, Fargate also apply across vendors. Not that we think switching across vendors is very much, you know, popular, but we want a consistent experience for deploying across all the vendors. And then also bringing in some edge compute on top of that to do some interesting proxying is also what we're looking into. So it's exciting. It's early, but we'll probably launch that. I think it's going to come out in January.
Okay, looking forward to that because that kind of reminds me of the famous or infamous Prime Video article about how they started with serverless because, again, it's about the time to market. Yeah. They don't know if anyone's going to use this tool that they're building. It got popular, so they started to see, you know, cost going up, and so they, you know, migrated, they moved and re-architected to run on containers instead of step functions to save on cost. Which is, you know, yep, which is what evolution, well, what do you call it? Evolutionary architecture is all about, right? That you evolve the architecture over time as your context change. So I guess it's just going to make that migration a lot easier so that you're not worried about, okay, if we build the next ChatGPT that we may not have time to quickly rewrite everything and move everything from Lambda to containers. So if there's easy way for you to do that switch, that might actually help more adoption of serverless because that switch becomes easy. Then it's something that you don't worry about as opposed to thinking, oh, if we do need to switch, that's going to be a month's worth of work versus just okay, a few minutes, change a few settings, and bang, you're done. So I think that would be really interesting. Story and something that, like I said, I do think is very relevant for a lot of companies that are that are building new products, but knowing that there's a chance that they can find the market fit, and then suddenly, your traffic is going to go up like that, so you have to react pretty quickly.
Yeah, ever since that Prime article came out, it just felt like, well, the response in large part was like, well, I guess we can't do serverless anymore. Like, no,
no,
it's crazy. Like, this is still the best architecture in town for getting to market quickly at incredibly low cost with few resources, right? We just need to fix the architecture so that flexibility is baked in. And it's got to be up to the dev tools to just make this possible, you know, and we probably should have done this a while ago.
Yeah, the article actually talks about how they didn't spend a lot of time to rewrite the application because they had very good modularity in the code already. So they actually talked about that it was quite easy for them to move the whole thing from step functions and Lambda to container. But again, that requires the discipline and the good engineering practices, which you can't always count on. So I think that's where
it's hard
tooling support
when you're going 0 to 1.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that's where tooling support really comes in. And that's one of the things I think one of the reasons why I still prefer serverless framework over something like CDK is because there's a set of conventions conventions and opinions that's already baked into the framework that's going to give you good good default, good best practice out of the box. Whereas with CDK, you can just do whatever you want. So everyone is doing whatever they want. So there's just no convention. There's no guardrails in place. Talking about this evolution of start with serverless, then you go to containers. Once it gets more expensive, they need to optimize for efficiency and cost. then having that baked into the tooling means that everyone is going to do things in a way that is portable, if that's something that, you know, that's important to them, as opposed to it only applies to teams who has thought about this ahead of time and has done the good engineering so that they have that modularity they need. I've seen so many companies that struggle to move out of whatever decisions they made. It wasn't just about serverless. I've had worked for companies where they spent 2 years trying to get out of this .NET web framework because all of the business logic is written into the request handler. There's no modularity, so they couldn't get out of the web framework, let alone whatever compute platform that we're talking about here. So, instead of having to rely entirely on the good engineering practices, having good tooling support is going to make that a lot more easy and feasible, and hopefully make people less scared about starting with a serverless on their next project.
That flexibility, I think, is going to be a real game changer for the architecture, if we could pull it off. And again, it's not going to be perfect. A lot of stuff you're talking about, it just comes down to like the way you write your code. We're not gonna be able to solve all those problems, but we're gonna chip away at a lot of them, I think. And it's partly enabled by kind of changes in the underlying infrastructure as a service, right? These things are evolving. And it looks like that this is now more possible than ever as a result. And I think if we solve that, we'll have done something hopefully pretty meaningful for the next chapter of serverless. So I guess to kind of wrap up on the V4 changes overall, we're changing a lot of things. But the themes, we believe strongly that there's new challenges that we need to solve. It's going to take a lot of work to do that. And we've got some pretty killer solutions on the table. We haven't talked just about reliability and just a lot of core improvements in serverless framework. So there's a ton of those coming, including a support package for actually paying users and whatnot. And then we have this exploration of what does the serverless architecture version 2 look like? How do we enable this world where you could start, never pay for idle on Lambda and whatnot and get to market really quickly, but then have the flexibility built in to optimize for cost, performance, and whatnot later down the road. And then lastly, let's revisit infrastructure as code overall. And let's explore something new here. Let's see if we could build more sustainable community, better end product for end users, over time with actually sharing some of this revenue, with creators. So lots of exciting stuff upcoming. And you'll see us probably ship a beta in December of V4. It'll be early and we'll just be building it in public. And we want to go GA by end of January.
Okay, great. Looking forward to that. And best of luck. I really hope you guys put it off.
Yeah, I love this space. Yeah, as I know you do too, right? I mean, what a great opportunity to be able to work on stuff like this and give people these great tools and like the empowerment that comes with it. I mean, it's very cool. And then you throw AI into the mix. And, sometimes when you're growing up, it kind of feels like there's so many people in the world doing so many things. Like, how do I ever stand a chance in like making a dent in the universe and doing something meaningful? It's like, well, I think the answer is in like serverless services and these incredible building blocks. And then you add in AI on top of that. And, the world is filled with interesting people doing a lot of different things. But I think the power that individuals will have to actually make great change and great solutions will be greater than ever because of all this stuff.
Yeah, with serverless and AI, you can nowadays you can build so much just scrappy guys on Twitter talking about how they build all of these wonderful things just on their own. That kind of thing is just unthinkable. Maybe like going back 5-10 years, but nowadays with all the tools and technologies available to us, anyone can do it really.
That's what it's all about. That's what gets me out of bed in the morning after all this time. Because it could be quite a grind, as you know.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, we are just over time already, but Austin, thank you so much for taking the time to speak to us today. And yeah, looking forward to the beta launch, and hopefully by the time you listen to this or watch this episode, it's already available, so you can go and sign up and try it out, the new extensions mechanism. And yeah, best of luck. And I hope you guys pull this this thing off. And yeah, looking forward to what you guys do next.
All right. Thanks. Yeah. Appreciate your support.
Take it easy. And goodbye, everyone. So that's it for another episode of Real World Serverless. To access the show notes, please go to realworldserverless.com. If you want to learn how to build production-ready serverless applications, please check out my upcoming courses at productionreadyserverless.com. And I'll see you guys next time.